Okay, Andrew, when you talk about gap in service, and that comes up quite a bit, is that an arbitrary notion, the gap in service, and who is responsible or who owns that onus to define if there's a gap in service?
Okay. Federal law doesn't technically define a significant gap in service, but when you say who owns it, you can own it. Your board can own it if you choose to. Now, it's not enough to prove a gap in service. They have to prove a significant gap in service. Now, under the federal law of the First Circuit, and they've addressed this, if the applicant comes in and is claiming they suffer from a significant gap in service, the First Circuit Court of Appeals says that the board can look at the gap and determine as a question of fact if it's a significant gap. What does that mean? Well, how large is the gap geographically? How many customers for the carrier will be affected by the gap? You can look at a case. I'll give you the citation. It was the OmniPoint Holding case, OmniPoint Holdings versus City of Cranston, 586 F 3rd 38, 2009. And it says, for example, when relevant, courts assessing whether coverage gap is significant should consider inter alia, the physical size of the gap, the area in which there is a gap, the number of users the gap affects, and whether all the carrier's users in that area are similarly effective. By contrast, if they're talking about a capacity deficiency, the court talks about that you can consider relevant data about the percentages of unsuccessful calls or inadequate service during calls in the gap area. Your board, you must arm your board with the ability to ask for the evidence they need to enable them to make a determination as to whether or not a significant gap actually exists. And this is critical in 5G because in the vast majority of rollout, there are no gaps. They already have 4G service. They're going in with 5G service because they want to discontinue other services like 3G. And many federal courts say, if a carrier has sufficient service in 4G and 3G, they can't claim there's a gap in service because they don't have 5G. And that was the Extenet case. I just won a case in July of this past year. And a site developer went into a neighborhood, a very affluent neighborhood, and wanted to install DOS nodes roughly every 150 feet. And they provided evidence that a carrier had allegedly had a significant gap in its 5G service. Significantly, this carrier provides service on 7 different frequencies. They only provided evidence of gap in 2 of the 7 frequencies that the carrier provides its services in. Based upon the record we created before the local zoning authority, the local zoning authority denied the application. The site developer sued, and this is a 5G rollout, and claimed that it was an effective prohibition. The federal district court in the Second Circuit said, no, when we look at this, you must recognize that when you're using a carrier service, let's say you're on 5G and you're driving around. If you're on your phone using 5G service and the 5G signal strength drops too low to maintain the call, your phone will downshift to 4G, and if necessary, 3G, and if necessary, 1G. And they acknowledged that that would work. And the federal court said, no, they haven't proven a gap in service. To prove a gap in service, they actually have to prove that in a geographic area, their end-use customers cannot use their phone to connect to a landline. Now, again, it's a factual determination to be made by your board, but you should, in your code, give them guidance. What evidence should they ask for to enable them to make an informed decision? Because if they make an informed decision, and there's evidence in the record to support it, federal courts are loath to overturn their decisions. Yes, if a federal lawsuit is filed, and they always file a lawsuit saying it wasn't based upon substantial evidence, the federal judge will do a de novo review. They'll look at the evidence again. But the general rule of thumb is if there's any plausible basis for finding that the evidence was sufficient to support their conclusion, even if the judge would have decided otherwise, they will not disturb the factual determination of your local board. In the words of the First Circuit, we give extreme deference to the factual determinations of local boards. Your problem is your local zoning code doesn't tell your local board what factual determinations they must make, doesn't tell them what evidence to ask for, and doesn't guide them as to how to make those determinations and create a proper decision, which would be all but immune to challenge, because it's not even a question of winning if you get sued. It's a question of creating a record which will dissuade any applicant whose application is denied from bothering to file a lawsuit in the first place.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. Let's open it up again. Any counselors have further questions? Councilor Austin.
Thank you. Several of our local folks here have asked about if there are ways to prevent this entirely. And what I'm hearing from you, and please confirm if I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly or in the right direction, is that there is coverage is considered to be comprehensive enough if there is adequate 3G and 4G coverage. If there is actual missing coverage, for example, a zone where calls are dropped significantly, that might be an argument for bringing in a new technology as opposed to a previously, you know, issued standards. So a lot of discussion has been happening around the ideas of, you know, a moratorium or some way to prevent this entirely. And what I'm sensing from you is that there may not be ways to entirely eliminate the technology, but we can significantly strengthen the capacity of our review boards to make determinations on a very strict basis by giving them very specific points of questioning and requiring documentation by any applicant. So it's not that we can wholesale say we don't ever want 5G, because that would be a prohibition, which is a problem, correct?
Right. Okay, so let me try to pull that apart. So first of all, I would never recommend adopting an ordinance designed to just stop 5G technology. I would never do that. However, I would recommend that the city consider measures to make sure that they are maintained in a safe manner. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but let me just talk about the 5G rollout first. Most of the 5G rollout is being carried out through the installation of small wireless facilities and DAS systems. That stands for distributed antenna systems. Small wireless facilities are typically facilities that are physically smaller and installed at a lower elevation, but they operate independently. DAS systems, by comparison, are distributed antenna systems. They can't work by themselves. There'll be a DAS system where you have 18 to 43 nodes spread throughout a residential neighborhood, and they all work together as one unit. And while they're generally thought of as less intrusive because they're not as large and they're installed at much lower elevations, those minimizing factors are offset by the fact that they're being built very, very close to people's homes. I've seen them as close as 6 feet to someone's kitchen window, right in the middle of the kitchen window. So they do have the potential for adverse impacts of the type that you would traditionally consider for any other zoning application, like an adverse aesthetic impact or reduction in property values. Even worse, many 5G site developers, I should say, are claiming that because they should be treated as a public utility, they have the right to use public utility easements. And they will literally go into people's backyards or on their front yards and install facilities without the homeowner's permission, and claiming that they have a right to do it. Now, as far as the radiation emissions from 5G, it is my understanding that the output is much more powerful. The signal travels a shorter distance. And the problem, well, I'm not going to address whether the level of radiations deemed by the FCC are safe or not. That's being litigated as we speak. That's going to take decades. What is most concerning to me and might be concerning to local governments is that not a question of whether the general population limits are safe, but whether or not they're enforced, because from my perspective, they're not being enforced. What that means is when a facility gets built, the FCC never tests these facilities and never requires the owners to test them. And as a result, many local jurisdictions, starting in California, started drafting ordinances which include random testing requirements. And what they do is they don't tell the operator that it's going to be tested. They will bring an RF engineer who will randomly test the facility. And if they find the facility emitting radiation levels which exceed the general population exposure limits, then there's a process by which they can revoke the permit. They give the owner of the facility notice, an opportunity to be heard. They have a hearing. And at the have the hearing, they have to show cause why their permit shouldn't be revoked and why they shouldn't be fined. Local governments would probably be wise to adopt random testing requirements. Now, as long as the town or the city pays for it, it's not a problem. The time you get most saber rattling is where jurisdictions actually impose the cost of this random testing on the applicant. They're claiming that violates the Telecommunications Act. But merely having that is great, because if you have random testing requirements, the owners and operators of the facility are on notice, because no facility operator wants it to come out in the press that there was testing done and it showed that their facility was emitting radiation levels that were illegally excessive. So just by having that random testing provision in there, it's kind of a watchdog to make sure that they don't exceed the FCC's limits.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from council before we move on? Mary, did you have anything you would like to add? Mary Costa.